of all the chapters in the Abrahamic narrative in Genesis, Genesis chapter 16 portrays Father Abraham and Mother Sarah at their weakest. In this chapter, we see the impatience of Abraham and Sarah, an impatience born out of unbelief. We see them taking things into their own hands, as if God's hands weren't sufficient to do the work. And we also see an inversion of leadership in the home. On the other hand, we see little of their faith in this chapter. There is faith, but little of it. And we see, therefore, little of the obedience of faith as well. And sadly, it's the same way with the children of Abraham too. We've got chapters like Genesis 16 as well. Abraham and Sarah then have more to learn about God's covenant. We saw about God's covenant the last couple of weeks, that God promised that Abraham would have a seed as innumerable as the stars of heaven. And God promised that he would rather destroy himself than break this covenant with Abraham. But here in chapter 16, the next chapter in the scriptures, Abraham and Sarah are impatient. They take things into their own hands, and there are disastrous effects both in the short term and in the long term, some of which effects are still with us today. Throughout all this, God maintains his covenant. The machinations of Sarah and Abraham do not realize the covenant at all. Instead, they bring grief and trouble, and as much as lay within them, they would have destroyed the covenant. But Almighty God, in his sovereign grace, realizes the covenant in spite of their sins. And God then, in chapter 17 and later on in the Abrahamic narrative, teaches Abraham more about the covenant and makes things even clearer. This week we're going to consider, though, the birth of Ishmael. We'll see, first of all, how his parents, Abraham and Hagar, came together. Then we'll look at the grief caused by Hagar's being pregnant with Ishmael. And lastly, we'll consider how Hagar was met by God's messenger in the wilderness, induced to return to her mistress, Sarah, and then brought forth Ishmael. Consider then the birth of Ishmael, the foolish marriage, quote-unquote marriage, the domestic strife, and the angel's message. The birth of Ishmael, the foolish marriage, the domestic strife, and the angel's message. So what happens in the early verses of our chapter? Well, after 10 years in the promised land, Abraham and Sarah still don't have a child. Sarah then comes up with a plan. The plan is, Abraham, you will marry and sleep with my handmaid, Hagar. And then, God willing, Hagar will have a child, and Hagar's child will be my child. And that'll be the seed of the covenant, the seed of the promise. And that way God will be able to fulfill his promise to us. Abraham, he agrees. He marries Hagar, he sleeps with Hagar, and Hagar conceives. That, in short, summarizes the first 3 or 4 verses. Now, that's a sorry tale. And we're going to see just how it is that it's a sorry tale. The first thing that the child of God should realize, even in that brief narration of events, is that this is an attack on God's good institution of marriage. Jesus Christ himself, in Matthew chapter 19, taught us that Genesis 1 and 2 is the foundational revelation about marriage. Jesus said in response to the Pharisees on that occasion, Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? That's God ordained, Genesis chapter 1. And then God said, Genesis 2, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore, they are no more twain, but one flesh. Christ here teaches us monogamy. Mono meaning one, and gami for the Greek word for marriage. One marriage between one man and one woman in a one flesh relationship. That is marriage. Sarah is proposing bigamy. And bigamy means two marriages at the one time. Bi meaning two, like bicycle, two wheels. She proposes that Hagar becomes Abraham's concubine. And a concubine is sort of a lower wife. That's enough for us to be going on with. And Hagar is to become Abraham's concubine for the purpose of producing a son for Abraham and Sarah. The son won't be Hagar's, it will be Sarah's. That's the plan. And this idea of taking a concubine in order to produce a son for the first wife, normally when the first wife was barren, this idea was common in Abraham's day. It's a prevalent sin of that age about which Abraham and Sarah, well, they'd become accustomed to it and didn't see it for the evil that it was. Rachel and Leah, later on in the book of Genesis, they fell into this sin too, in that Rachel proposed Jacob sleep with Bilhah, her handmaid, so that Rachel would obtain a son by Jacob. And then Leah, seeing what Rachel was up to with her handmaid, she wanted more children, and then she gave her handmaid Zilpah to sleep with Jacob. The patriarchs fell into this evil. And extra biblical data, that is material not recorded in the Bible, gleaned from archaeology and other sources, indicates that this sin of marrying a concubine to gain a son or a daughter, usually a son, that's the idea, this was widespread in the ancient Near Eastern world. So Father Abraham becomes a bigamist. Now, if you read the book of Genesis up to this point, Genesis chapter 16, you'll see that the only person so far that has been mentioned as being a bigamist, doubtless there were others, but this is the only one mentioned in the Bible, is Lamech, wicked Lamech of the reprobate line of Cain. And he wasn't only a bigamist, he was a murderer. What's striking is that Sarah, and not Abraham himself, Sarah is the one who proposes this bigamous relationship. Now, why did she do this? This is a rather extreme course of action. Well, Sarah looked at what seemed to her to be the facts of the case. I'm barren. I've been barren for the last 10 years. In fact, I'm now past the age of having children at all. Let's face it, I'm not going to have any more children. Now, God says Abraham is going to have a seed. How am I going to have children if I'm past the age of bearing? Then, Sarai blames God for this. Verse 2, Sarai said unto Abraham, these are the first words recorded of her in this chapter, behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. And I say there's an element of blame in this for God. She knows, as we all know, that the Lord opens the womb and the Lord closes the womb. God had promised Abraham was going to be a seed. We've been in the land 10 years, nothing has happened. God's holding out on us. He's not being good. That element of blame must be understood in this. And so if God isn't going to fulfill his promise and give Abraham a seed, then I'll have to take over and come up with some methods of my own. And just think about it. And evidently this is what Sarah did. She did think about it. The solution is ready to hand. There's a common custom in our day. Everybody does it, especially the people who are in the sort of situation I'm in. That husband takes concubine. Concubine gives birth. And the child of the concubine becomes the mistress's son. And look at the situation we're in. Hasn't God blessed Abraham, my husband, so that he has plenty of silver and gold and plenty, especially, of servants and maid servants? Well, there we are. Solution's easy. Abraham, marry Hagar. But we need to ask ourselves, too, this question. Why was it that Sarah wanted a child in the first place? And we ought to say here that Sarah did not want a child chiefly for the first reason which might suggest itself to us, namely that she wanted the joys that children bring. Sarai's problem was not that the nursery was empty. That's a problem for any childless woman. But that wasn't her chief problem. Sarai wanted a son because she understood that her salvation was tied up in the birth of a son. Because the Messiah was going to descend through her seed. That's what she understood. And so the motivation of Sarah in wanting a child was in part good. It wasn't merely to have children, which is a natural, understandable thing, but it was especially this good motive: the Christ must come. A seed is necessary. So mixed with these sins was in part this good motive. But I say sins, and I say sins rightly. Involved, first of all, in her sin was the sin of impatience, the impatience of unbelief. Now, it's true that God had not yet promised that Abraham's son would come through Sarah. He hadn't said that in so many words. But Sarah could have thought to herself, remember that time we went down into Egypt? God wouldn't actually let Pharaoh sleep with me. Why was that? In fact, God went to great lengths and plagued him. Why was that? Then she could have thought to herself, well, God has a purpose with me, that I will bring forth the son after all. And then she should have thought something else about God, that God is the God of the impossible. Is anything too hard for the Lord? The angel later says to Sarah in Genesis chapter 18. And then we should be able to trust God to fulfill his word. And it was out of this impatience of Sarah's unbelief that she proposed this sinful marriage. Now again, I put marriage in inverted commas because Abraham's real marriage was with Sarah, and this other thing was illegitimate and sinful. And so she's saying to Abraham, in effect, let us do evil that good may come. And that isn't the ethic of the Christian church. That is the ethic of the Jesuits. The end justifies the means. If you have a good end in view, you can do whatever you want to fulfill it. That is their ethic from their own mouths. But that's not the ethic of the child of God. And then we ought to think too of Sarah's attitude towards Hagar. She is in effect using Hagar as a sort of baby machine. Hagar, you're useful for one thing. You produce for me a child, and then I'll take the child, and it'll not be your child. I'll just take the child away and it'll be my child. She'll bring this baby into the world only to lose it to me. That's cruel. And Abraham, of course, he's not blameless in all this either. Sarah comes to him with this proposal in verse 2 of Genesis 16. And what ought Abraham to have done? He ought to have said to her, now Sarai, don't speak as some of the foolish women speak, to take the words of Job in chapter 2. This proposal of yours is contrary to the truth of marriage, which is a one flesh union between one man and one woman for life. And Sarai, I will not marry and sleep with another woman, even if you ask me to marry and sleep with another woman, because this is sinful. That's what he ought to have said to her. And Sarai, he ought to have added, if it is God's will that you bring forth the promised seed, well then, God will miraculously give you conception. If you're the one who is to be the mother of the seed, God will see to it, and we don't need to take things into our own hands. The prophet says later on, he that believeth shall not make haste. That is, he who believes will not be hasty and take things into their own hands. Abraham, though, had his guard taken down. And he had his guard taken down because it was his wife that said this to him. And he wasn't expecting temptation from his wife. Sarai was a godly woman. She's presented in 1 Peter chapter 3 as the model for Christian women. The mother of Christian women. And when we do well, we imitate her. And here Abraham suffered the same difficulties that Adam had. Eve proved to be the tempter of Adam, and Adam fell, and Sarah proved to be the tempter of Father Abraham, and he too sinned. And the children of Abraham ought to learn from this that sinful counsel must be rejected, even if it comes from your best friend, even if it comes from your parents, even if it comes from your husband or your wife or your church or your minister. You do not follow evil counsel, no matter who it is from. Because the scripture teaches us in the book of Acts, we ought to obey God rather than men. And when there's a conflict between your best friend, your father, your mother, anybody who's really close to you, in fact, all the world, if all the world says you do something and God says you do the opposite, you do what God says. Because we ought to obey God rather than man. And in all this too, we notice an inversion of proper order. Abraham was the head of his wife, and here she leads him. Now, it's not a sin for a husband to take the advice of his wife, and may well be in times a sin not to take the advice of your wife. But here, the order is inverted. But then you say this seems to be very sore on Christian women, that they are the ones leading their husbands into sin. But even in the Abrahamic narrative, we see it goes the other way too. Because Abraham led her into sin when the two of them went down into Egypt. Sarah, say you're my sister. And now she returns the compliment, so to speak, and leads him into sin. Both instances, you'll note, have to do with marriage issues. And in this, Father Abraham and Mother Sarah have many children too. How many times have Christian husbands not led their wives, Christian wives, into sin, and Christian wives led their husbands, Christian husbands, into sin too? And so Hagar is married by Abraham, and Abraham sleeps with Hagar. And you can just imagine Sarah spending the night alone. And she knows that she's alone because her husband is sleeping with another woman that she gave to him. And obviously, this must have occurred several times, because the goal in this is Hagar's conception, and this may take time. But she brought it on her own head, and she sleeps alone while Abraham sleeps with this other woman. And then, Hagar becomes pregnant, and that makes things worse. That brings upon the whole household all manner of domestic strife. And the first element in this domestic strife is Hagar's despising of her mistress Sarah. Verse 4 says, Abraham went in unto Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. Now who is this Hagar? Hagar, as I said earlier, is a handmaiden or maid servant. She is an Egyptian maid servant. That's important. We'll say more about that later on. But as an Egyptian maid servant, she was probably picked up when Abraham and Sarah were in Egypt at the end of chapter 12. Maybe she was one of those whom Pharaoh gave to Father Abraham as a gift to shoo him out of the country. But now this handmaiden is a wife, or rather a concubine, to Father Abraham. She's gone up in the world. She is the wife of a rich and powerful man. She's the wife of a man who is greatly blessed by God, the man who is to inherit Canaan and to have a great seed. And that seed, she thinks, is my child. Now Hagar thinks, I'm not just a concubine in that I have given Abraham seed. I am going to be the number one wife of Abraham. That's quite a status. And so her attitude to Hagar changes. She thinks and acts towards Hagar like an equal. I'm your equal. We're both married. Married to the same man. You'll not be bossing me around anymore. In fact, I'm your superior. Because you've been married for Abraham for all these years, including 10 of which you've spent with him in Canaan, and you've produced no seed. And now, I'm going to bear him seed, and I'm the younger, seed-producing wife of Abraham. And this sudden elevation of a mere maidservant is too much for her. It goes to her head. She's puffed up because of her own importance, and Sarah is despised in her eyes. And Proverbs chapter 30 speaks to this sort of thing. Proverbs 30 verse 21. For three things the earth is disquieted, and for four which it cannot bear. One, for a servant when he reigneth. Two, a fool when he is filled with meat. Three, an odious woman when she is married. And four, an handmaid that is heir to her mistress. And if the earth is disquieted and cannot bear a handmaid being heir to her mistress, then no doubt Sarah is disquieted and she can't bear it either. And Sarah's reaction to the uppityness of Hagar is, though understandable, sinful. Sarai feels it absolutely insufferable the way Hagar now treats her, and she then goes to her head, Abraham. And you think, well, that's good, she's now going to her husband, but she doesn't go to her husband in the right attitude. In fact, she blames Abraham for the whole thing. Abraham, she says, verse 5, my wrong be upon thee. That is, the wrong done to me by Hagar is due to you. It's all your fault, the way I'm being treated by this Egyptian handmaid. And so Sarah, sinfully, doesn't accept any of the blame, even though she started the whole thing, and she now shifts the blame to Abraham. All these things I'm suffering, it's because of you. It's all your fault. And so Sarah then, believing herself to be innocent, calls upon God to judge between them. My wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. And this calling upon God's name is breaking the third commandment, because it's taking God's name in vain, calling upon him to judge unnecessarily in this circumstance, when Sarah herself is largely to blame, because the whole thing started with her sinful proposal. And then Sarah sinfully reacts, because Hagar sinfully reacts, and then Abraham, he joins in too. Abraham's sin is abdicating his headship. He says in response to Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand, do to her as it pleaseth thee. Abraham now is in a position of weakness. What else can he do? He shouldn't have agreed to the whole arrangement in the first place. Now he's in the miserable situation that his wife and his concubine are at loggerheads. He knows that he can't possibly satisfy both, and he decides that he'll side with his angry wife. And he feels, what else can I do? At this point, it becomes clear to both Abraham and Sarai that their plan to obtain a seed has failed. Sarai won't go for it. She won't let Hagar's son inherit. No way. And Abraham, he realizes that God's blessing has not been obtained by their ploy, and so he's willing to let Sarah do what she wants with Hagar, and thereby with Hagar's child, and he knows what's likely to happen because of her anger. And then Sarah goes back to her, this domestic strife. Sarah, she sins further. Now that she is Abraham's leave, she treats Hagar harshly. And Hagar, she is a part in this sin as well. Hagar, instead of humbling herself, now she feels, I've been badly treated, and she runs off towards her home country, off to Egypt. And the child of Abraham can only look upon this story today as a mess. Strife, rivalry, insubordination, blame shifting, and cruelty. All this, mind you, in the home of Father Abraham. When God himself says later on, in Genesis chapter 18, that Abraham's house is filled with justice and judgment. The tables have been turned. And why did this all come about? Impatience. Trying to help God fulfill his promise. Taking Satan's shortcut. And this teaches us that the children of Abraham today must not take sinful shortcuts to try and realize God's covenant. I'll give you an example of a sort of thing. God has made a promise in his covenant of grace, we saw this last week, that we will inherit the eternal Canaan. But the Christian doesn't take shortcuts and commit suicide when things go black. And the Christian doesn't think, whenever his hopes for glory are so ardent, that he ought to commit suicide either, because God has appointed the way as well as the end. We walk in obedience to God, and we go when God takes us, and not when we decide we've had enough. Or here's another promise that the church has. Christ has promised that he will build his church. But what do you do with a promise like that when the church doesn't seem to grow? Well, you don't say, well, Christ has promised to build his church, and we must give him a hand. We've got biblical and reformed doctrine. We'll water that down and then enable people to join the church who don't agree with us doctrinally. Or maybe we should neglect church discipline out of fear of annoying other church members. Then they might leave. Got to help God along. Or, and this is a very popular one today, in order to gain young people, we're told, that we need to imitate the entertainment of the world. Bring Christian pop music and trendy worship into the church of Jesus Christ. That'll help Christ, that'll help him build his church. See what wisdom we have in the church. And this sin, theologically, is the sin of Arminianism. The sin of Arminianism, at bottom, is saying that God cannot save us. We need to cast the deciding vote. Synergism. We work with God. So God has a promise, God has a covenant. He's going to build his church, and then we need to bring in man's entertainment, or bring in man's views of church discipline, or unbiblical doctrine. The truth is that we do not help God. We never can help God, because God is God, and he is absolutely self-sufficient. And our righteousness does not add one whit of blessedness to God, because he's self-sufficient. All his joys and blessedness are of himself, in his own infinite being. And if God is not happy, so to speak, in his own infinite blessedness, then you or I, with our little might, could never add anything to his depths. And it's striking, too, that in this Abrahamic narrative, Egypt is presented as the way of turning from God's promise and covenant. God's going to give Abraham a seed. God's going to give Abraham the land. And Egypt is the way of turning aside from God's promise. When there was a famine in the land, way back in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham ought to have stayed put and seen, and God would have provided for him. But what does he do? He runs out of the land that God has given him to Egypt. That's the problem. Later on, when Lot is presented with the choice, which part of the land would you like, he goes to the cities of the plain, because that area was well watered everywhere, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest into Zoar, chapter 13, verse 10. Egypt is the way off from God's covenant. And this woman, Hagar, she's an Egyptian. She's an Egyptian. And here are the children of the covenant, the Israelites of God, turning to Egypt and seeing if Egypt can help us realize the covenant. And people are turning to Egypt, as I said earlier, and seeing that God will realize the covenant, and turning to worldly entertainment as the means to grow the church of Christ. Madness. And the passage itself stresses that Hagar is an Egyptian. Verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had an handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. We're told she was an Egyptian even before we're told her name, because it's more important that she's an Egyptian than what her name happened to be. Verse 3. Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and caused Abraham to marry her. So now, for the seed of the covenant to be realized and for Christ to come, we need the help of ungodly Egypt. That's what it's come to for Father Abraham. And the temptation which came to the people of God in the wilderness wanderings, when they didn't really believe that God loved them and that God would take them into the promised land, the temptation was, let's get a captain and we'll go back to Egypt. Let's have the onions and the garlic of Egypt. That's the way it is with the people of God. When we turn from God's word, there only is one place to turn: the world and the bondage of the world. Seeking the liberty of Christ in the bondage of the world. And that is folly. And under this hard treatment of Sarai, Hagar flees towards Egypt, her home. Verse 7, it says there that after she fled, the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur, which was the way to Egypt. Now here we have the first reference in the scripture to the angel of the Lord. And who is this angel? The answer is that this angel is Christ. Christ in an Old Testament pre-incarnation appearance. He's called the angel of the Lord. Verse 10, Christ says to Hagar, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. Can an angel multiply someone's seed in their generations so that they have a great multitude? Then look at verse 19 and verse 20. I'll stick with verse 20 just of chapter 17. God says, that's made clear in the verse of 19, and he's still speaking, as for Ishmael, I have heard thee, behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. God multiplies Ishmael's line. And if that is not sufficient to prove it, turn to verse 13 of Genesis 16. She, that is Hagar, called the name of the Lord that spake to her, Jehovah, thou God seest me. The angel is God, the Lord. And this angel of the Lord is developed. The truth of him is developed through the scriptures. He's the angel of the Lord in Genesis. He's called the angel of God's face in Exodus. In Joshua, he's called the captain of the Lord's host, Joshua chapter 5, and he's the one that won all the battles in the land of Canaan under Joshua. And then in Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament in the arrangement of our canon, Malachi calls Christ the angel or messenger of the covenant. So Christ comes to bring God's face as God's captain and as the messenger of God's covenant in the New Testament. And so Christ comes to Hagar, and verse 7 says he finds her. And this finding of Hagar is finding her in grace and mercy. Hagar's an Egyptian. She's a handmaid. She's a fugitive. She's in the wilderness. She's in the sin of pride and rebellion. And she's afflicted. She's the lowest point of her life in many ways. And she was only a handmaid. And Christ comes to her in grace and mercy. And in the grace and mercy too, we believe, of the cross, he finds her as a lost sheep. And Christ says important things to Hagar by this fountain, or as it's later called, a well. The first thing Christ says to her is to remind her of her identity. He says, verse 8, Hagar, Sarah's maid, you must know who you are. You've had a son by Abraham, but you're still Sarah's maid. He asks her a question. Where have you come from? Where are you going? She responds, verse 8, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. Now the angels are speaking to her. She's owning up. Yes, she is my mistress. And then Christ comes to her, verse 9, and says, return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands. Here's the fifth commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother, which includes honoring your master and mistress. Now you have sinned in running away. You ought rather even to have taken the abuse and suffered it righteously and quietly. You've sinned. You must return. You must go back. Humble yourself and go back to Father Abraham's house. And this is the word of Jesus Christ to runaway slaves. Return. Go back to your master. And this is the word of Jesus Christ, I say, to runaway slaves, because we had one such runaway slave in the book of Philemon. Onesimus ran away, was converted, and Paul told him, go back to your master. This is the word too of Jesus Christ to runaway children. We think of running away from home because their parents supposedly are so mean and nasty that they can't stick it anymore. And this is the word too to children who think of running away from home. Return. Return. Honor your father and your mother. And after this command for her to return, and by the way, return and submit, that is, put yourself under them, humble yourself, and then obey them, what they tell you to do. After this call comes the promise, verse 11. Behold, thou art with child. She knew that. Now the angel is telling her even clearly, you really are with child. You shall bear a son. Wasn't sure at this stage whether it was going to be a boy or a girl. Now the angel tells her, thou shalt call his name Ishmael. Here's a name for the boy. Call him Ishmael. Because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And the name Ishmael means God hears. God heard your affliction, Hagar. And that's why I'm come here, as the angel of the Lord. And I want to tell you something about this son you are going to have. He will be a wild man. In fact, the original actually calls him a wild donkey. You're going to have a son and he's going to be a wild donkey. Not literally now, but figuratively. He's going to have the character of a wild donkey. Job 39 speaks of this wild donkey. Verse 5, who hath sent out the wild ass free? Or who hath loosed the bands of the wild ass? Whose house I have made the wilderness, and the barren land his dwellings. He scorneth the multitude of the city, neither regardeth he the crying of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searcheth after every green thing. The wild ass, then, he doesn't live in a city or a town. He lives away from people, in the wilderness, in the mountain, and no one can tame him. He does what he wants. You're going to have a son, Ishmael. This will be his character. He will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. He'll be contrary, a fighter. Can't get on with him, and he'll be off on his own. And then Hagar, in response to this visitation of the angel of the Lord, calls the Lord who visited her, thou God seest me. She realized, through Christ finding her in the wilderness, that God really did know everything and knew her and cared for her and sent his messenger. She called the well at which Christ appeared to her Beer, which means well, Lahai, which means living, and Roy, which comes from the word sea. Beer, Lahai, Roy, the living God who sees me. Or, I have seen God, the living God, and lived. Because seeing God ordinarily, especially in the book of Genesis and Exodus, means death. And this woman, Hagar, she obeyed the call of the angel. She went back to Abraham. She bore a son to Abraham when Abraham was 86 years old. And he was Abraham's son. And Abraham called him Ishmael. But she wasn't Sarai's son. Sarai's son's yet to come. And we'll look at that, God willing, next week. Amen.